Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. Arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. As we approach the on-air portion of our fall membership campaign in early October, we're trying to go back to what we started very recently, and that was to raise as much money toward our $150,000 goal before we even go on the air and interrupt any of your favorite programs. It's been proven successful, and we're counting on you once again to keep the on-air portion of our membership campaign as short as possible, and we quit as soon as we reach our goal. Help make that happen with a trip to kvcrnews.org/support. On tonight's KVC Arts, we'll have music from Trans-Siberian Orchestra as Ross French speaks with musical director and original guitarist Al Petrelli. TSO will be at Citizens Business Bank Arena December 2nd. Tickets and information at kvcrnews.org/events. We'll also have Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Daniel Durston, playing the role of Elvis Presley in Million Dollar Quartet at the Fox in Riverside, October 5th. Again, tickets and information at kvcrnews.org/events. First, though, it's art, music, and lectures at Scripps College. It's Scripps Presents. We'll be speaking with Karina Lesser, Director of Public Events and Community Programs at Scripps College.
I was actually brought here to Scripps from a place called the Chicago Humanities Festival. I was doing public programming. And Scripps has a long history of doing amazing events. But up until a few years ago, we weren't doing it as a season. And so once this position became available, there was a real desire to put together a real public programming series that would create a really amazing forum for not only our Scripps community and the Claremont Consortium, but also for the larger Southern California area, you know, the Inland Empire and also Los Angeles. So a lot of my job is really thinking about what kinds of programming will be a complement to Scripps's curriculum. We have a really fantastic classic but also contemporary humanities curriculum here. Students are taking classes across the disciplines, and our public programming is an opportunity to sort of extend those conversations into a public forum.
We're going to be speaking about Scripps Presents, but you alluded to the fact that Scripps is a member of the Claremont Consortium.
Correct.
Talk about what that is. This would be truly a foreign concept for a lot of people.
Sure. And, you know, there really are very few consortiums in America.
Yeah.
It's a really special thing. And here at the Claremont Consortium, we're comprised of five undergraduate colleges: Pomona, Pitzer, Claremont McKenna, Harvey Mudd, and Scripps. And Scripps is actually the women's college that's a part of the consortium. And there are a few graduate institutions as well. What makes it so fantastic is that each institution has its own curriculum and tenor, I would say, but students are able to take classes at all of the different colleges. And there actually are some programs that serve across the consortium. So our Intercollegiate Feminist Center is an example. It's for students at Scripps, because it is a women's college, they benefit from being in an environment where women's leadership is a focal point, but they have an opportunity to take advantage of a more traditional social setting. Students actually can major at another college, even though their degree is being granted by the institution that they're enrolled at. So I think that the kinds of conversations that result from that and the range of academic explorations is really rich and varied, because students are able to take advantage of faculty from, you know, five different colleges,
yes,
as opposed to just the one that they're enrolled in.
Nice, nice. Again, we're about to be talking about Scripps Presents, but before we even go into this, let's hit the best website for more information.
That's scrippscollege.edu/scripps-presents. For more information, folks can call 909-607-1870.
Fantastic. And we'll get that out again at the end of this. Now, a phenomenal lineup of speakers, art, music. We'll touch on a few of them right now. I noticed there are a few professors from Pomona College. Tell me about how the entire lineup was booked.
Sure. So we actually have two strains that run throughout our Scripps Presents series. So you'll see that there are a number of what I call evening marquee events that typically feature slightly more well-known individuals who are coming from further afield to reflect on their experiences and to sort of share their perspectives. The other line of programming that we do is a program that actually predates my time at the college and is much beloved, called the Tuesday Noon Series, which, as the name suggests, happens on Tuesdays at noon. And we actually co-curate that series with other entities at the college. So a handful of those are curated by Scripps Presents, but what you'll see there as well, we work with the Scripps College Humanities Institute, oftentimes address a different theme each year. And so the Noontime series is a chance for them to bring in consortium faculty and also, you know, directors of nonprofit organizations around the region who really address the issue at hand. And for the Humanities Institute this year, that theme is immigration, which is, gotcha, as we can all agree, incredibly timely. So I have actually Hao Wong, who is faculty in the music department and also the Humanities Institute director, to thank for a lot of the selections for those Tuesday Noon programs that deal with immigration. Some of the other ones that you'll see as a part of our series, a line of programming that I personally am always very excited about. I actually started my career working in book publishing at a place called Houghton Mifflin in Boston. And we love to play host to folks who are on book tour. You know, it's a really wonderful way to kind of get some of the people that everyone is reading and talking about, to get them sort of at that moment.
Quite timely lecture, and this one goes with a Pomona College professor on October 3rd. Tell us about this.
Gilda Ochoa is coming on October 3rd, well, just coming up the street, I guess, because she is at Pomona. This is, again, one of the programs that we curated with the Humanities Institute, and she is a sociologist and also teaches in the Chicano and Latino Studies program. And a lot of her research has actually been really grounded in understanding the immigrant communities in Los Angeles. So again, I think for us, being able to sort of look beyond, you know, the university walls to the communities that we are right up next to me, feels really important for our students to be able to have that experience. And so having a sociologist who has been sort of out in the communities, talking to immigrants and understanding the issues that they're facing on a daily basis and bringing that perspective back to our campus is essential.
That one again, Latina and Latino Migration Roots and Resistance. This again, part of the Tuesday at Noon series. This one on October 3rd. Then we have a concert coming up October 8th.
That's right. What's wonderful about this show, again, it's a Los Angeles-based group called La Victoria. It is a trio of all female mariachi musicians. That's actually what I love about this series. And again, because Scripps is a women's college, we have a really wonderful opportunity to particularly highlight women artists and thinkers. And the Bessie Bartlett Frankel concert is a longstanding tradition at the college, and we do it every fall. So La Victoria is at the center of that this year. Their music is really lively and is definitely a contemporary take on the mariachi tradition. And they collaborate with really amazing people who are sort of unexpected. Rage Against the Machines, Tom Morello is somebody who they've worked with in the past. So I think people will get some of the pleasures they might expect from mariachi, but again, with sort of a contemporary and really kind of political flair. So that's happening on October 8th.
I love the fact that we just got female mariachi band and Rage Against the Machine in one breath. That's going to be sweet. That was Karina Lesser, Director of Public Events and Community Programs at Scripps College. Again, more information at scrippscollege.edu/scripps-presents or call 909-607-1870. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, it's music from Trans-Siberian Orchestra and Ross French in conversation with musical director and original guitarist Al Petrelli. Trans-Siberian Orchestra will be at Citizens Business Bank Arena December 2nd. Again, tickets and information at kvcrnews.org/events. Now, as we go into Shout and before we go back to KVC Arts, take a moment, please, to go to kvcrnews.org/support. We are approaching the on-air portion of our fall membership campaign, but we'll be interrupting programs less with your help. We cease fundraising as soon as we hit our goal of $150,000, so we may not even need to go on the air if we wrap up early. Help continue this type of programming here at 91.9 KVCR. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, it's music from Trans-Siberian Orchestra and Ross French in conversation with musical director and original guitarist Al Petrelli. First, though, we have Lillian Vasquez and more on another musical opportunity in Riverside soon.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right.
I'm speaking with Daniel Durston, who is playing Elvis Presley in the musical Million Dollar Quartet, which will be at the Fox Performing Arts Center on October 5th. So, kind of a new show. Tell me the background of Million Dollar Quartet.
It's about an actual event that happened on December 4th, 1956, over at Sun Records. Carl Perkins was actually having a recording session, and Sam Phillips decided to gather Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Elvis Presley together. So this night is historic in music history, and it actually did happen where they all got to hang out, have a couple drinks, and jam to each other's songs, some old gospel music, and just have a good time for a couple hours. If you look it up, you can find the actual recording that they did that night that Sam ended up throwing on the record button, you know? Pretty exciting.
So where does it all take place? Was it down in Memphis?
Yeah, Memphis, Tennessee at Sun Records, where each one of these iconic characters got their start with Sam Phillips in the exact studio where Elvis got his start when he started recording with Sam with his earlier tunes, you know?
So it was kind of a happenstance. One of them happened to be there, and he called in a few more of the guys, and they all came and jammed, and now there's a musical about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Carl Perkins had his own session that day, and Elvis is on his way from Las Vegas to visit his mom. So Sam was like, hey, come on by. And then he called up Johnny Cash and was like, well, Elvis is going to be here. You should stop by. And Jerry Lee was very new at the time, so they brought that guy along to play on some of Carl Perkins' records, and so there it was, all four of them.
And who actually put together the show? How did the show come about, the musical?
Its first initial run was over in Chicago by the writers Floyd Matrix and Colin Escott, which originally there's a book that they had, and Floyd got a hold of it and Chuck Mead, and they said, we could make a musical out of this. This could be a stage version where you actually get to hear the songs they got to play and put it on, you know? So throughout the show, you hear quite a bit of the songs that actually were performed that night, and quite a bit that we could only assume were probably performed there that night without the recording from 56 and before. And throughout the show, you kind of get the storyline of each character, how they got started. We kind of do a little flashback here and there of how it all began, and then up till that day. The audience is kind of like the fly on the wall, living in the moment kind of thing.
Very cool. How did you come to play the role of Elvis Presley?
It's actually a span of 6 years, believe it or not. Ever since the show was on Broadway, I became a huge fan. I've been a fan of Elvis Presley and this style of music, thanks to my parents. But ever since it was on Broadway, I was like, oh, this is something I would love to do, you know? And I've been auditioning for it ever since when it started the national tour. And I've gotten quite a bit of callbacks, but it never really stuck. And so after so many years, I was like, I can't give up now. I've done way too many. I've flown to New York way too many times. And if I give up now, it's all for naught. And I kept going. And finally, this time through a video audition, the one time I don't fly out, our director, Suzanne, believed in me, and the whole creative team agreed. I actually auditioned for Johnny Cash, believe it or not, and when we did our Skype interview, they said, can you just play one Elvis song? And I was like, sure, you know, I've done that before. Let me pull this one out, and it was, that's all right, Mama. About a week later, I got the call that I got the part.
I'm leaving town, baby. I'm leaving town to show. Well, then you won't be bothered with me hanging around your door, but that's all right. It's all right. It's all right, my mama. Anyway, do. Ah, da da dee 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 dee. I need your loving. It's all right. It's all right, my mama.
What was your video that you sent to them? What did that consist of?
Oh, the initial video is Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash. And I'm 6'2", so I was like, oh, I'm pretty tall, so they'll probably want me as Johnny Cash. But I did Folsom Prison in a couple acting sides, just alone in a room, you know? And they're like, this is great. We like to do a Skype interview. And I was like, awesome, because I'm from Los Angeles, and they're based in Virginia, and they're auditioning in New York. So I was like, sorry, I can't afford to go out there, but hear the video. And when I got on Skype, they said, let's hear that Elvis one. And then I was like, great. And surprisingly, they had never asked me to dance on video. And luckily, in my genes somewhere down the line, my mom and dad were dancers. So it kind of came out of nowhere. But yeah, it was exciting stuff and really cool that they took a chance on me by way of video, you know, from YouTube video and just talking on Skype, which is really telling of who our creative team is, you know.
And it saved you a few $100. You didn't have to take a red eye.
Oh, my God.
A flight to New York.
Yeah, I've done it a few times in my life, so I know that it's either pays $350 round trip, but you have to take three planes each way, or if you want to do a straight shot, it's about $650 to $750. Definitely save some cash there.
Well, I'm tired and so weary, but I'm
So tell me, when you went in the past and you tried to do the auditions in person, what was that experience? Were you trying again for this particular show and trying for Johnny Cash?
Initially, I strictly went in for Elvis every time.
Okay.
And eventually, I did enough research where other guys who played Johnny Cash went in for Elvis, and, you know, the creative team was like, hey, go out and learn an Elvis song and come back in, or vice versa, you know? And so once I did all that research, I was like, oh, I could probably do both, so just learn the different voices and different songs.
There will be peace in the valley for me someday. There will be peace in the valley for me.
I was prepared always with both characters in mind, but I always went in for Elvis because that's a dream of mine. So I went in, and often they would tell me to sing the other character's song, so I was always prepared. Sometimes get a call back, you know, stay the night at a friend's house in New York, come back the next day and do the same thing again, you know, and it's gotten pretty close before, but again, it never really stuck, whether they had someone else in mind or not. It was enough for me to realize I'm not making a mistake. Clearly, they see something in me. So I'm going to keep doing it, you know, and now 6 years later, it finally pays off.
Well, that's great. Tell me some of the songs that you actually get to perform now that you're playing the role of Elvis Presley in this production. What are some of the songs you perform?
Well, one of my favorites is actually That's All Right, Mama, which is his very early years, which is actually, you know, one of the songs that he first recorded with Sam Phillips. So you get the earlier year, and then you get like his gospel side where we do Peace in the Valley. Elvis is on lead vocal in that, and so you got to kind of get the more gospel, soulful Elvis voice in there, but you also have the rest of the guys backing me up with harmonies. My final song of the show, it's kind of like a concert section at the end where I get to sing Hound Dog.
Oh, nice.
And we all know how huge that song is. It's also another different type of Elvis voice, so it's pretty cool for me as a performer. I get to do three different types of Elvis voicings. It was the journey, and now my voice is used to all of it, and it's really fun to just pop into these different style songs every 10, 15 minutes or so, you know?
Oh, Lord, I pray there be no sadness, no sorrow, oh, my Lord, no trouble I see. There will be peace in the valley for me,
You ain't nothing but a hound.
Of us play our instruments and we're playing live. There's no tracks or clicks or anything, but there is Elvis's girlfriend who actually was there on the actual historical night. Her real name is Marilyn Evans, but in the show her name's Diane. The real girlfriend was actually a dancer from Las Vegas. In our show, she's a singer from Los Angeles. Other than that, we have Sam Phillips, who is essentially the narrator of the show, kind of connects the audience with the show. We also have our drummer and bassist, who at the time in the story are actually Carl Perkins' band members. Carl Perkins' brother on bass and Fluke on drums. So yeah, it's an 8-person ensemble cast, which I like to say we're all lead characters in the show, which is pretty exciting. Even Diane, Elvis' girlfriend, has two songs of her own in the show. So it's pretty exciting to see it all come together.
And now you're touring around the U.S. or just different parts. What does your tour consist of?
we started in Virginia with A Month Sit Down over at the Barda Theater in Abingdon, and now we just kicked off our national tour about 2 weeks ago. We're flying everywhere. It's all over the place, and we actually get to go to Canada next week. But for the most part, it's a U.S. tour, and it's an open-ended tour, so who knows how long it's going to last, and hopefully it lasts longer than we could ever wish for.
Well, that's nice. And this time when you're flying, you're on their dime, not on yours. So that's even better.
Oh, yeah. That changes everything for me. Yeah, it's great to, you know, experience the road while working. There's nothing better than that.
I hope you'll take advantage of the places that you stop into. A lot of times performers can't. They go to the hotel, do their show, and move on. But hopefully you'll get a chance to see a little bit of the countryside while you're touring.
Oh, yeah. You know, we actually just came from a historical mansion that we just saw here in Bangor, Maine. We try to take any off day or maybe even a couple hours before showtime to find out what's historical about the area. Outside of that, a lot of us are coffee lovers, so we try to find the most obscure hipster coffee shop to try to go test it out.
Very
good.
Because
we're all from major cities, so Starbucks is awesome, but we'll take a little hipster coffee shop any day.
I'm speaking with Daniel Durston, who is playing the role of Elvis Presley in Million Dollar Quartet, and it'll soon be at the Fox Performing Arts Center on October 5th. Now, you currently live in the Inland Empire. Did you grow up in this area?
Yeah, I was actually born at the Upland San Antonio Hospital, and I was raised my entire life in Ontario, California. So for me, this is the closest it gets to home, which is, as anyone else would know, maybe 15-minute drive or so on a good day.
Right, so you might have some family members in the audience that day.
Oh, yeah, I have a ton of people already texting me about
tickets.
Family and friends are going to show up.
So when did you start performing? How did you get your start?
Actually, it's all thanks to a movie called That Thing You Do. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I have.
It's a movie Tom Hanks wrote and directed.
Yes.
And my dad actually took me to go see that when I was 9 years old. And I left the theater and literally told him, I don't ever want to go to college. I want to do that forever. And I'm pretty sure that's not the best thing for a dad to hear. But my dad was a drummer growing up, so he said, sure, like, sounds good, and went and bought me a guitar within, you know, maybe a couple months of that. I have four older brothers, so we all got to play the guitar, and we had a drum set. A couple of us stuck with it, but I lucked out with having the support of my parents and all my brothers when I said I want to tour for the rest of my life. I just stuck with it, and guitar and drums were my main instruments. And then I started playing bass guitar for jazz band and marching band in high school, and I started touring with different bands and different musicals as a bassist. And now here I am, back to my roots of playing guitar, finally on a dream role of mine, a dream show of mine.
And you're actually getting paid for it. It's even better.
Yeah, real money, yeah. Because I grew up playing in my own band where I had to pay the band members, or none of us got paid at all, you know? And the typical story of touring in a white van and eating at Waffle House was very real. And it's very nice, you know, come back around to, oh, I get to eat real meals and stay in my own bedroom. I don't have to sleep in a van. Yeah, it's rewarding, you know, more than I could ever imagine. Join those moments with those band members who essentially molded who I am today, and my teachers who taught me. You know, as I said, I didn't go to college, so those teachers actually were the ones that taught me quite a bit as far as reading sheet music and being part of the ensemble.
So they were a big influence for you. Were you in theater, or were you just in the music?
No, theater was a huge part. When I was a sophomore in high school, I actually had a friend made me audition for Grease, and I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. And he's part of my band, so I was like, fine, if you're going to do it, I'll just do the ensemble. It's fine. I got cast as the ensemble and ended up getting, as they say, bit by the theater bug, and I've never looked back since.
Why didn't you want to be in Grease? It's a great show.
It is. It was actually super fun, and, you know, I was a musician, so I didn't think theater was a thing for me. I thought it wasn't cool. I thought it was lame and this and that, and it's so funny because literally I could never thank my friend enough for making me do that. Because after that one show, he didn't have to make me do anything. I don't think he even did shows after that. I ended up doing about, I think, 15 musicals after that, community theater-wise. You know, not getting paid, just doing it because I loved it. My parents, you know, dropping me off, picking me up from rehearsals and doing all that. But that's where I got my real training from. Luckily, my director and now great friend, Dave Matheson from the area, is truly the guy who molded me as an actor and as a stage performer. That's where I got all my training from, you know, and from there I just started touring as a musician and auditioning for musicals like crazy. And this is my first professional musical I've ever been a part of as an actor, as a stage actor.
There's not a day that goes by without me thinking of that one time we should have kissed. Flash forward to this moment here, pretty eyes wind in your hair, we're in love and quietly you make me think, oh, I'm the lucky one. Oh, 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 I'm the lucky one. Oh, oh. lucky one, lucky I've got you.
You know, when I was looking at your website, I noticed that you also write your own music, and I listened to all of them that are on your website, and I got to say my favorite was Lucky One, and I think that could be a wedding song. Forget the Carpenter song. They could use Lucky One. Who or what inspired you to write that song?
If I think back enough, it's inspired by three different girls.
Oh, nice.
But oftentimes, I write music when I'm just starting to have a crush on a girl, because that's when I'm most inspired. Everything that's so new, you know? And I've been in a couple relationships where the girl said, I'm so lucky to be with you. I'm so lucky that you're part of my life. And I truly felt at the time like I really thought I was the lucky one. And I don't think they really understood or believed me when I said it. So I wrote a song about it.
It's a very nice song. I think it could be played at weddings.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thanks for listening to those. That means a lot.
Oh, I'm the lucky one. Oh, I'm the lucky one. Lucky I've got you. And I've got you.
You were describing some of the things you've done, and for a pretty young guy, you've done quite a bit on your website listing all your stuff. What's next on your agenda, or what would you like to do before you hit the age of 40?
Oh, wow, a ton of things, but this truly is a dream show of mine, and I wouldn't mind doing this for the next 5 years or so, specifically as Elvis, would be amazing. Another dream, though, as far as musicals go, I would love to be in the Jersey Boys someday.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I'm a huge fan of Captain Hook, and I played that role a couple times community-wise. And if I could be Captain Hook or Gaston, I can do that forever. I could literally do that until I'm 60. I'd be happy. Outside of that, I'm going to continue to write my own music. You know, if that goes anywhere, amazing. You know, that's such a dream to do all that. But I also understand it has its own setbacks or hurdles. And I've gotten this far as musical theater goes. And if I could keep taking this further and further, I couldn't be happier, you know?
So when you get your first big award, who will you thank? And have you written that speech?
Oh, man, I spent many a night as a teenager watching YouTube videos about that. Just, you know, people winning Tony Awards or Grammys. In the end, I have hundreds of people to thank from my hometown. But in the end, it always finishes with my parents, you know? They're the ones who dropped everything to make sure not only to live a good life and be brought up in a good household, but also to support a career that isn't always promising. Not only that, but they would go to every single show, not only my bands, but in high school and community shows. They would see Peter Pan 20 times in a row. They wouldn't miss a show. And growing up, I thought that was normal. And I grew up and met a ton of people in my life. And not a lot of people are that lucky to have parents who support that much. And, you know, I never took it for granted, but now I appreciate it more than ever. And that's what really has made me who I am today. And that I never forget, you know. And now that I'm on tour, they can't come to every show, but that's all right. It's understood. And I never forget my roots. It all comes down to my parents and my four older brothers who dealt with me practicing songs in the garage with them or in my room.
What's your mom and dad's first name?
My mom is Dorothy Durston and my dad is Dwayne Durston.
Well, Dorothy and Dwayne, we think you've done a good job raising this young man. Daniel Durston will perform as Elvis Presley in the Million Dollar Quartet at the Fox Performing Arts Center on October 5th. Thanks, Daniel.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Good luck and break a leg.
Elvis has left the building.
That was Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Daniel Durston, Elvis for the time being. Tickets and information for Million Dollar Quartet at kvcrnews.org/events. You're listening to KVCR Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Up in just a moment, it's Ross French in conversation with musical director and original guitarist with Trans-Siberian Orchestra, Al Petrelli. Before we get there, though, please take a moment to go to kvcrnews.org/support. We are approaching the on-air portion of our fall membership campaign, and we'll be interrupting programs less with your help in that we cease fundraising as soon as we hit our goal of $150,000. So we may not even need to go on the air if we wrap up early. Be a part of this membership campaign by making a financial pledge of support at kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks.
You're listening to KVC Arts, and we're chatting with Al Petrelli, musical director and guitarist for Trans-Siberian Orchestra. TSO will be playing a pair of shows at the Citizens Business Bank Arena in Ontario on Saturday, December 2nd. And Al, welcome back to KVC Arts. Thanks for joining us again.
Well, thank you so much for having me back, buddy. Hope everybody's good by you.
It's a great day here in Southern California. We're looking forward to having you back here on December 2nd. By my count, the band is making its fifth visit to Ontario this holiday season. And while it's hard to imagine anyone who hasn't heard your music during the holidays over the last few years, they may not be as familiar with the band itself. So how would you describe Trans-Siberian Orchestra to someone who's not familiar with it?
Well, first of all, I think it's safe to say that Trans-Siberian Orchestra encompasses all different genres and styles of music kind of rolled into one. I mean, there's everything from the great composers. You know, we have the Fifth Symphony by Beethoven and Mozart's 24th Symphony that we perform, right through heavy metal, rock and roll, R&B, jazz. When I was a kid growing up in New York, there was only one or two radio stations on AM radio. So there wasn't like genre-specific or formatted radio back then. It was whatever was popular at the time was coming through my father's car stereo and his Le Mans. You know, so Paul O'Neill, who created TSO, and everybody involved, anybody our age, we kind of grew up listening to, you know, Miles Davis, Frank Sinatra, Beatles, the Beach Boys, Andrew Lloyd Webber's work, you know, all the show tunes that made it to radio. So if you take all those things and roll them into one musically, that's only the beginning of a TSO show. If you're a fan of Broadway and theater presentations, well, that's another aspect of it. The story that we're bringing to life this year is called The Ghost of Christmas Eve, which is almost a very Frank Capra-esque tale that Paul O'Neill wrote a bunch of years ago about a teenage runaway taking shelter in an abandoned theater on Christmas Eve. Aside from that, you have hands down the biggest production of any arena rock show ever. We have 18 tractor trailers with more pyro, lasers, moving trusses, video screens, special effects than anybody else touring right now. So for 2 hours and 20 minutes, you're not only going to see a great show or hear a great show, but it's going to be a complete, like, sensory overload, if you will.
Right.
You know, we don't want anybody ever to walk out of that arena saying, it was okay. You know, that would break all of our hearts. We want people to go, oh, my God, that was the most amazing thing we'd ever seen. And we want to come back next year and bring my grandparents or my grandchildren or coworkers or whomever. And that's what's been going on for the better part of 18 or 19 years of touring now.
You mentioned the how you cross genres. It's curious to me, do you see different age groups coming, and do you actually see people, like when you guys do your post-show meet and greets, people saying, I didn't think I was going to like you, but I love you, or that sort of thing, or older group, older
fans? Yeah, absolutely. A lot of that. It's like, you know, I didn't know what to expect, and I'm so glad so-and-so brought me. My husband bought me tickets for my birthday. I'd never heard your music before. I'd never seen you guys before. You know, I've heard your music, but I didn't know what to expect. You know, a lot of them think, you know, we're a bunch of Russians, you know, playing classical music all night. Like, no, dude, that ain't it at all. You know, I mean, I've had people walk online 8 months pregnant saying this is, you know, my baby-to-be's first concert. Like, okay, you need a wheelchair and you need to sit down and breathe. My youngest daughter, Layla, came to her first show. She was 8 months old last year. My other daughter, Olivia, is 6 years old. She comes. My oldest son, who's a sniper in the Special Forces, is 32 years old. He's there. My mom, my grandma, I mean, you name it, they're in the audience, you know. So I'll look down and I'll constantly just, like, roll my eyes in disbelief going, I can't believe that the art form that Paul O'Neill created and the concert experience that he invented is, it's just like you said, not only not genre-specific, but there is no age demographic involved whatsoever. Everybody loves this show.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit about the tour. You mentioned you have 18 trucks, but the logistics of this thing are almost unfathomable from the outside. TSO is playing two sets of bands, playing 100 shows in 60 cities starting November 16th, 18 trucks. How do you guys get from show to show, and how long does it take to set up?
Well, first of all, it's 18 trucks per tour, meaning, you know, the East Coast band, as they're known, who does basically the 13 colonies, has 18 trucks, an incredible road crew on their side, and then my side, which covers the rest of the country, has an additional 18 trucks. The crew has about 30 days to build the set for the first show. We get into rehearsals in Omaha, Nebraska, late October, and the crew rehearses the show as much as the band rehearses the show. 30 days to set up the first show, and by the next day, I think we leave Omaha, and I think, I don't know, either we're in Denver or wherever we'll be. They'll have 8 hours to set up the second show. Wow. That's because they are the best of the best of the best. It even comes down to rehearsing how the trucks back into the arena in what order. I mean, it's just like a military operation watching this unfurl every day. And we've never missed a downbeat, you know. I don't want to jinx myself, but snowstorms, you know, road closures, foul weather, whatever's going on, these trucks will plow through. We will be there. We will set up and we will put on the biggest rock show ever.
For those who go to the show, it's almost as interesting to watch the deconstruction of the stage afterwards, this swath of people coming in and starting to take things apart. Really remarkable.
Isn't that crazy, though? I mean, it'll take 6 or 7 hours to put it together. It'll take them 45 minutes to put it back in the trucks because they're tired and they want to have a drink and go to bed.
Yeah, and how mobile the stage is, that it slides out into the audience and comes apart. It was really quite the technical feat. It was really impressive to watch.
Well, it's amazing because all these things were created either by Paul O'Neill or for Paul O'Neill. You know, it's really difficult to have a stage of that size. It's basically like a city underneath the stage. So the fact that they said, okay, we can build the stage in the middle of the arena, hang all the points at the end of the arena, and we'll just have 200 people wheel the stage into place. You know, there's always something being built. We're like the kings of multitasking.
When you come to Omaha for your rehearsals in October, do you know how the show is going to be shaped at that point, or is it a mystery to you?
Kind of, maybe 80% of it. You know, I know mostly what songs are being done. Pretty much, again, the rock opera portion of it, the Ghost of Christmas Eve, you know, I know from start to finish how that's going to go musically. But I don't know until maybe a week into rehearsals in Omaha exactly what it's going to look like or placement of instrumentation and things like that. So it really is a very fast-paced but detailed rehearsal schedule.
And are you running the full fire effects and pyro and everything each time, or...?
I'd say by the last week is when we'll run the show with full production. So we'll do the show at least twice a day for 30 days. And by probably about 6 or 7 days before show number one, we'll run everything. You know, we're all fully dressed, all lights, pyro, everything. Because what I promised everybody, most importantly what I promised Paul O'Neill and what he has promised the world, is that everybody will have a perfect first show. You know, it may be our 50th show, but for the folks in your community, it'll be your first time seeing us this year, and you will have a perfect first show for yourselves.
You're listening to KVC Arts, and we're talking with Al Petrelli, the musical director and guitarist for the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. So this year, as you said, Ghost of Christmas Eve. Now, that's based on the 1999 made-for-TV movie that starred Ossie Davis. You were in that, and it will be shown on KVCR-TV during the month of October, October 4th and October 7th at 8 and 9 p.m., and then later on throughout the holiday season. Can you tell us a little bit about the show and how it's similar and how it's different than what you might see on TV?
Well, it'll be pretty much the same songs. The story is what the story is. I mean, it's become a timeless tale of loss and redemption. Again, going back to this teenage runaway, you know, she ends up kind of taking refuge in this abandoned theater on Christmas Eve. And, you know, in a very Frank Capra-esque manner, you know, Paul introduces her to the ghosts that occupy this building and circuitously takes her on this journey until she has the wherewithal to get back home to her parents. You know, magically, there's enough money placed in a golden envelope for her to get bus fare home. She realizes during this that nothing is that important to not speak to your parents or speak to your loved ones for any length of time, never mind run away from them. You know, whatever happened, nothing is that important to cause parents to lose their child. So it's very, very similar to the movie. As a matter of fact, the movie is being played on these like massive 100-foot video screens behind us while the band is performing. So the band becomes the soundtrack for the film, and the film becomes the images for the band's work.
And you have a narrator who's telling the story throughout the evening.
Yeah, we have on my side, it's Philip Brandon. And on the other side, it's a gentleman named Brian Hicks. And these two guys, they're like Shakespearean actors. They start to talk, and even I stop dead in my tracks and just listen to every word they're saying. Because talk about artistry personified. I mean, just to stand in front of a microphone and having, you know, 15 or 16,000 people in an arena silent, you could hear a pin drop because they're just telling this tale, and they just kind of wrap you up in it, and you get lost in that moment like a good novel.
Yeah, there's an art to storytelling, and it's one of those things that you don't quite experience if you're, you know, you can listen to the CD and hear the amazing music, but to not have that narration there. I remember the first time I saw the show, that really was moving to see Philip's work describing and leading into each piece.
Yeah, he's incredible. I mean, he's so good at what he does. And I had told him last year, I said, I've been here, you know, from day one, listening to Paul's work, helping him record it. But every time Philip opens his mouth, I actually just listen to every syllable that's coming out, and it's a brand new story for me each time. Because like I said earlier, everybody misses somebody around the holidays. And when you listen to the story, you can make the story your own. And I find myself getting lost in it because, you know, I miss my kids, I miss my wife, I miss my family around the holidays. I got two boys that are in the armed forces. And, you know, when Philip's telling that story, you know, I can't help but, to, you know, my heart kind of skips a beat because, you know, I hope they're safe. I hope they're okay. I got one boy who's a touring musician. I hope to God that he's safe, you know. So everybody in the audience relates to it, but everybody on stage does as well.
You're listening to KVC Arts, and we're talking with Al Petrelli, the musical director and guitarist for the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. You've mentioned Paul O'Neill a couple of times. Paul O'Neill passed away back in April at the age of 61. Can you talk a little bit about Paul, what he meant to you both personally and professionally?
Oh, my God. For the rest of my life, I could speak about him. Look, Paul was... First and foremost, my boss. He was my best friend. He was my big brother. He was my teacher, you know, my mentor. You know, he created this art form that I was just proud to be part of. There's a hole or a void in my heart that will remain empty for the rest of my life. I don't want anybody to fill that. You know, that's Paul's place to live forever with me. I can only imagine, you know, what his wife and his daughter and the rest of the immediate family is going through right now. I mean, you know, all our thoughts and prayers go to them, and I appreciate you bringing that up because, you know, it was a much better planet with Paul on it. I'll miss him forever, but with his family at the helm of the ship, you know, his legacy will live on forever. You know, that was one of the things Paul always talked about, was how, you know, when Walt Disney passed away in the early 60s, you know, the family who was there from the beginning, just like Paul's family has been there from the beginning, you know, steered the ship. And they continued on to build the dynasty and the empire that it is and will always be. Paul always said, he goes, I want TSO to live 100 years past all of us. You know, I don't think any of us wanted that clock to start ticking just now, though.
What did the band do? How did the band plan to move forward in his absence?
I don't think there was an actual plan. I think, again, there was never a doubt or a question in anybody's mind that we would carry on. You know, Paul is such a workaholic. He had, you know, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, a 20-year plan, you know, implemented at all times. I mean, he and his family, along with our very talented department heads, we all knew what was going to go on for the next 5 or 10 tours and 5 or 10 CDs that, you know, are partially recorded and yet to be completed. You know, it's funny because yesterday I got done doing a bunch of interviews and I kind of hung up the phone and I just clicked on whatever app was on my phone. And here we are with the iPhone 10. And, you know, Steve Jobs, rest his soul, passed away a bunch of years ago. Yet there's always something new coming out. I mean, that man, like any other, you know, great inventor and artist, had these things years ahead of where they were at the present. So, you know, this legacy, again, thanks to his family, will continue on. And every note that's played, every lyric that's sung, every pyro hit that goes off will be in honor of the man's genius.
It's really a family. I mean, also TSO lost bassist David Zabludowski, or David Z as he was better known, in a car accident earlier this year. And just from hearing you talk, this is such a family experience. Even though you guys are separated by 1,000 miles on the tour, this is one TSO, really, it sounds like.
No, it is. I mean, a lot of us have been together for many, many years. Paul had an incredible eye for talent. And Dave Z was definitely one of those people that, first of all, like an incredibly talented musician, and more importantly, just an incredible human being. I mean, he was the quintessential rock star. He lived, ate, breathed playing bass and making music, and he never had a bad word to say about anybody. He always smiled. I mean, he used to smile so much I'd want to smack him. You know, it's like, dude, can't you just wake up in a bad mood once? He's like, why? Look what I do for a living. And I'd look at him and go, good for you.
Nice.
You know? Again, a tragedy that, I mean, he was a very good friend. I've known him for about 15 or 16 years. But for the people that actually toured with him, they had such a deeper relationship, and I could only imagine what his family's going through right now. I think the greatest tragedy and horror that a parent can ever face is to bury their child. You know, so, I mean, my heart breaks for them first and foremost.
Fans are intimately familiar with your music, and you touched on this a little bit, but do you and your bandmates feel any pressure to make every show perfect? Because for some of them, this may be the first show, or they may be expecting it to sound exactly like it sounded on the CD. How do you keep that consistency day-to-day, performance to performance?
I don't know that if we feel pressure to do so. I mean, that's just the motto that Paul O'Neill created years ago. Every performance, you know, everybody deserves a perfect performance. Every year, the show will be bigger than it was last year. The only thing I can compare it to is when you have a Dynasty Super Bowl team, okay? Whomever that team may be. When I was a kid, it was the Dallas Cowboys or the Pittsburgh Steelers or more recent, let's say, the New England Patriots. Whoever your team is, doesn't really matter. But the point is that when a team wins a Super Bowl, next year they get back out to preseason and training camp and all that, and the Super Bowl ring that they're wearing is yesterday's news.
Right.
They want another ring. And they're just going to get in and start working harder than they did the previous year because it's a difficult task, but that's what professionals do. Paul taught me a long time that professionals don't practice till they get it right. They practice till they never get it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And in Paul's eye, perfect practice made perfect. Okay. So there's not a choice. It's not even a conversation. You know, we will be better this year than we were last year. We were pretty damn good last year.
Yep.
That was Ross French in conversation with Trans-Siberian Orchestra musical director and original guitarist Al Petrelli. TSO is coming to Citizens Business Bank Arena December 2nd. Tickets and information at kbcrnews.org/events. Just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Ross French and to Al Petrelli. Thanks to Karina Lesser with Scripps College and to Daniel Durston with Million Dollar Quartet. Here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Lillian Vasquez, and Jessica Greenwell. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts. Behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. Now, as we wrap up, please take a moment to go to kvcrnews.org/support and help us keep the on-air portion of our upcoming membership campaign as short as possible. It may not even happen if we raise our $150,000 goal before October 4th. We'll see what happens, but to help, it starts by making a pledge of financial support at kvcrnews.org/support. And David Fleming, thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.